On today's episode of Boyd Biomedical Design Stories, we're joined by Jim Biggins, the founder and CEO of Access Vascular, and Dr. Gary Ansel, president and CMO for Healthcare Insights. We'll be discussing Access Vascular's approach to innovation and advanced manufacturing in vascular care, and I'm joined by my co-host, Brian Johnson, president of MassMedic.
Here's a bit about our guests. Jim Biggins is the CEO and founder of Access Vascular. Jim previously held roles at Ocular Therapeutics, Boston Scientific, and Medtronic. Dr. Gary Ansel is the president and CMO of Healthcare Insights, and the past system medical chief of vascular program at Ohio Health. Dr. Ansel is an active clinical consultant and proceduralist in all aspects of vascular medicine and cardiology.
Jim and Gary, it's great to have you here. Welcome to the roundtable.
Pleasure being here. Thanks for having us.
Likewise. Thanks for having me.
So I'd like to start with a discussion about the vascular access market and then get a little bit into your technology, Jim, at Access Vascular. Maybe we could start with you, Gary, and really from the patient perspective, can you take us inside what happens when vascular access goes wrong?
Yeah, I'd be glad to do that. First off, this is really common. About 80% of the patients actually have a vascular access device put in them when they're in the hospital. So it's very common. What's not known is up to 30% will actually have a complication, whether it be infection or the catheter clots off or something along those lines. So it's a big part of a problem in the hospitals right now. You go into the hospital, say for a new joint, and you think, well, I'm going to get my new joint, I'm going to recover a little bit, and I'm going to go home. Well, you get a vascular access device, and now you get an infection. If you did go home, you're now back. And now you're going to be on IV antibiotics. And now you might have a clot, and that clot may go to your lung. So what went to a routine thing of making me feel better because I have now a new joint goes to a horrible experience from the patient's standpoint. So these are all on the scorecards of hospitals. They're a big focus right now in all the developed countries because complications that occur in a hospital are not good things.
Yeah, what's the cost implications for a hospital system on these on that 30% incident rate?
It's huge. It can be quoted at up to $90,000 per patient. And the reason being is you extend their length of stay. The time that they develop money for the hospital, realistically, from a business standpoint, is in those first few days. Now you tie up an ICU. Now not only are you actually building charges for that patient, but you're preventing up to three or four patients of getting in the hospital for their routine care. So it's a really big financial disaster for healthcare institutions, whether they pay attention to it or not. Yeah.
And it's a if it's a readmission, is there insurance implications for the hospital, reimbursement implications? Do they not get reimbursed for that readmission, or are they penalized for it?
It's a really good question. If you're a Medicare patient, yeah, there's penalties that occur. You may not get reimbursed for any of that readmission. And it also, you know, we're all paying attention to our hospitals now. There's LeapFrog, there's all these different scoring systems. It's your reputation. And if you have a reputation that's not very good, it's going to cost you now, day and age. And it's funny because I just went through a road sign the other day that said, not just delivering advanced care, doing it safely. And that's what we're really talking about.
I'm curious about that 30% number, though. Why such a high incident rate? Is it design, or is it just the open access to your vasculature, or like what makes it such a fertile ground for infection?
We have to remember our skin's an organ. And when you break the skin to put one of these plastic tubes in there, you create an opening for that bacteria to get in there. It also, blood is a really good bacteria growth we call Petri dish. So now you've actually developed a direct line to the Petri dish in your body. So that bacteria, which is on all our skins and, you know, the bad bacteria is actually what exists in a hospital, has a direct line, you know, pathway to that patient. So that's why it can happen so frequently. And then the technology hasn't changed for a long time. These are plastic tubes. They irritate, they form blood clot, they have all kinds of problems, but they're usually pretty cheap. So we've kind of, you know, not really tried to change or innovate it. So, but as it's now become more of a problem, we now are dealing with these hospital reputations. It's something that's more late. It wasn't happening a decade ago.
I think your perspective is so interesting because you were there for the, really for the start of this industry. I want to talk just a little bit about, I mean, how did the technology go into the hospital? Was it into every clinical specialty, or was it were there particular areas where it was adopted first? And has that contributed to some of the challenges? Is that it's not like a typical medical technology where it's really focused only in one area of medicine. It's really across the whole hospital, as you describe.
That's right. I mean, we use vascular access no matter what you're doing. And as I said, 80% of the patients isn't going to be done by one area of the hospital. So you have surgical areas, you have intensive care areas, you have cardiovascular areas, you have interventional radiology areas. And it's so common that many hospitals delegate this to the non-physician to actually implant. So there's a lot of checks and balances that are probably not in place because it could be done three different places in the hospital, three different ways or more.
Jim, I mean, from your perspective, you had to become a student of this space to come up with your innovation. And I want to talk a little bit about that story. How did you come to recognize this issue? And maybe a second question we'll come back to, but I want to just talk about what you just said, which is, why hasn't there been innovation for such a long period of time?
It was really because of a program at MassMedic called Ignite, which I think the program is still in existence, but I think it was one of the first classes to be involved with that program. And the advantage that provided me in order to identify a real unmet need, rather than sort of try to conceptualize something about a problem that may or may not be occurring, it was really an immersive experience. And it was through that process over maybe 18 months, talking to hospital administrators, talking to nurses, talking to, you name it. I got to witness procedures and talk to clinicians. It was sort of the recognition that this was a problem and that no one was doing anything about it. And then you look at the market itself, and I think vascular access as a whole globally is about $4.5 billion. Everyone uses the same materials, but they have a 30%, 25 to 30% failure rate. And so we should be doing better. Now, the second part of that question regarding why hasn't anyone done anything about it, I think that's a fairly common one. But if you look at it, how incentives align in any market, right? The incentive, if you own the market or you have some sort of decent market share, the way that you sort of maintain margins and become profitable is not to necessarily reinvent what's working for you in terms of revenue. So if you own 50, 60, 70% of the market, your incentive is to do, okay, well, we'll change the color, we'll change the lure lock, we'll do this, we'll do that. And if no one's taking your lunch, then everything is good and you don't have to make that investment. And so I think in a lot of these cases, it's a great question. I get it from investors all the time, but the truth is no one's incentivized to think outside of the box. Right. And so that's where, if you have a startup and you can find that unmet need, you have all the incentive in the world to innovate. And so that's sort of where the genesis of the company has come from.
I think your story about Ignite, and I'm really compelled by your story, and probably because of partly where I come from. I don't have a medical background. You're an entrepreneur who is able to access an area of the market and identify a problem, and that was because of the Ignite program. With all of your experience in a care setting, in hospitals, what's the best way to provide that kind of access to entrepreneurs?
Recently, the hospitals have actually decreased access to all their facilities, even just for people that are thinking about going into the medical field, like medical students and nurses have a really hard time doing the quote-unquote shadowing, those kind of things. I still think that one of the programs we started to talk about before COVID was to actually really partner with some of the incubators to allow that the engineers and the entrepreneurs get to see what's really going on in a hospital, because I said, unless you're there, you don't realize all the pain points that are there, and we've already accepted them. And so until you say, why did you have to do that? What did you do there? I don't think it's going to happen as much. And I do think that the one thing that's positive about COVID is we've gotten a lot better about like Zoom and the meetings and being able to really see things. And so hospitals are much better instrumented now for audio and visual. It's just getting that down so that the engineers and incubators can actually see things in the hospital on a daily basis and still protect the patient's privacy.
You said something, Kerry. Last 10 years, it's getting worse. This infection prevalence, or is that a combination of factors, or is it something to do with the technology or bacteria getting stronger and better in terms of or is it just merely that we've had a very strong focus and there's sort of a patient safety industry growing up that's crying attention to these matters?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both, actually. Certainly, you know, we've been using antibiotics really liberally in the United States, which has led to a lot of resistant organisms. So that makes it worse because now you have super bugs and you're trying to kill them with super drugs. You know, so that's one problem. The other problem is we are, you know, getting patients home faster. There's a, you know, a speed of trying to force recovery. And I think sometimes that can put the care of the catheters in maybe suboptimal areas. But I think that a lot of it is also recognition. We're holding institutions at a higher level. And why? Well, right up until recently, we got paid for all this. So if you had a complication, if you really weren't tracking your numbers and realizing that you're holding admissions out, you thought this was actually a pretty good business plan. You know, it's an annuity. But I think now we're getting more sophisticated with our value analyses to really realize the cost of these type of things. And the government's certainly putting a negative emphasis on this.
And I think the other thing that we see and we talk about in our work with your group at Healthcare Insights is really the transition from fee-for-service to value-based care. And so we've been talking about that as an industry for, I don't know, 15 years. And up until recently, it seems like that was sort of a pipe dream. But now that providers are sort of forcing or payers are forcing providers to look at those models more seriously and look at the total cost of care and what that means for the economics of these procedures, I feel like there is an emphasis on, okay, you know, really what is this costing us and are these things avoidable and do we have the optimal outcome for the dollars that are spent? And that's the thing that we talk a lot about when we work with your group and we focus on, okay, what is our innovation in the vascular access space really mean to a hospital? What are they really focused on in terms of the outcomes as it relates to dollars spent?
Right, I totally agree. And we're really seeing, actually, because of COVID, some negative steps. You saw a mass exodus of healthcare professionals out of the healthcare situation. So you had a lot of turnover, a lot of less experienced individuals. If you look at the lines and their infection and thromboses, they've actually increased during COVID. COVID causes clot, but it's also because you aren't going in the patient rooms as much. Everybody's concentrating on trying to separate themselves, and you're not touching patients as well. And so I think that, you know, we're going to have to revisit that, like Jim said, especially for the population management. We have to get better at focusing on safety and doing it with a value basis.
Jim, infection prevention, I mean, I've seen a lot of companies over the years kind of come through this, and I don't think you bill yourself as an infection prevention company, but
that's,
I mean,
right,
it's a tough space, even though the numbers seem very obvious. You probably get a lot of acceptance from the clinical side. Where's the biggest hurdle for innovation in this space?
I don't think the podcast is long enough for that. I think there, you know, we actually talked about this on the car ride over. It's, you know, as time goes by, things get much more complex, right? So rather than having a clinician pull in a product that they think is going to provide a better outcome, you're almost forced to go into an evaluation by hospital, like everyone starts to get involved, right? Hospital administrators, other clinicians, and so you have to go through a value analysis. And so being able to clearly translate the value proposition to not just a clinician anymore, but how do you convince supply chain and the person that's responsible for budget that this is something they should care about, when at the end of the day, the thing that they personally care about is being within budget for their particular category. And so the complexity or the challenge is really, how do you have an individualized story for each one of the people in the value chain that resonates with their particular, you know, lens. And so that's the biggest challenge for us. And I think, you know, as we discussed prior to setting up the conversation, we're seeing, once you start to get that ball rolling, once you figure out and walk through with some experienced individuals like Gary's group, what resonates with that entire group? What do they care about in that particular instance? How do you combine your story with what they care about to get through that evaluation? That's what resonates. And so it is complex. It's more complex than it ever has been, but taking that value proposition and really figuring out the story has been helpful.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very interesting to hear you both speaking about this change from fee-for-service to value-based care. And people don't like this answer, but I think the reality is there's good and bad in it, right? I mean, it's you can hear evidence of potentially it's an avenue to be able to provide a better value proposition for a new innovative product like what Access Vascular is bringing to the market, but potentially it's also a barrier to keep entrenched interests alive that possibly shouldn't.
I think what exists today is keeping new innovation out, right? The supply chain is trained and incentivized to keep innovation out of the hospital, right? The status quo is what works. They have contracts, they have bundles from very large companies that, you know, potentially prevent innovation. I think the good that could come out of value-based care is really if those bundles go away, right? If the incentive or the focus by the provider changes to, we don't care who we buy the product from. It just, whatever that bundle is, whatever that standardization of procedure is what gets us the best outcome, and that's what we're incentivized to do. I see the potential to disrupt the larger, less innovative companies from really boxing out small innovative companies like ourselves. That's my hope, and that's what I see anyways. If the providers are truly driven by value and the best outcome, doesn't matter how much marketing spin is on something, doesn't matter how much effort is put into making sure that smaller innovators are kept out, it's really just focused on that outcome. I think that's where I see the opportunity.
And does that track to your experience scaling Access Vascular into the market, that you're having different experiences in different healthcare settings?
Absolutely, and everyone wants to sort of paint a picture of, okay, this is how you get into the hospital. You have to be a part of GPO, you have to be on contract, you have to do this, you have to do that. But the reality is, right, once you step in the ring, as the saying goes, you figure it out really fast. And it's different everywhere, right? Like just even just going through the process of evaluation, getting an evaluation done, everyone has a different process. There are lots of ways to get around contracts, especially with an innovative product, and you just have to be able to navigate those things. So it is very, very inconsistent how that whole process works.
Are the most innovative hospitals adopting innovative technology, in your opinion, or does it seem to be outliers?
I have my opinion, but he's never talking about the man over here, so we'll see what he has to say.
That's a really good question. It really depends on, what your definition of innovation for the hospital is. Certainly ones that are focused on patient outcomes, Cleveland Clinic, Mayo Clinic, those kind of places, Stanford, they tend to be early evaluators. And, they do it in a very rigorous way to say what's real, what's not real, should we be going to this or shouldn't we be going to this? But I'd say the vast majority of community-based hospitals are really looking at status quo. I always tell people, change in medicine's hard. Once you get it, it usually sticks around. But, one of the biggest experience I have is many of the hospital and healthcare systems are margin-based. They haven't really looked at the details. And so you have all these silos, like supply chain versus your value committee, that really are, as Jim said, beating to a different drummer. And I think that's where the presentation by some of the new companies is changing, because companies spend a lot of money to get their PMA, to get their new device approved, and then they just send anybody in to try to get it on the shelf. My partners and I help run those committees, and what we know is there's good presentations, there's bad presentations. Bad presentations aren't getting on, and they're not coming back anytime soon. That's why we started what we're doing, is to make sure that people get trained on what is that driver for hospital administration. What do they think is vapor data that'll disappear as soon as they sign the contract versus real data? So the more efficient you are in your presentation and your benefit, your cost analysis, the more likely we think you'll be in having success getting into that hospital.
Shifting gears a little, looking forward, What are you guys most excited about in vascular access? I mean, either from an enabling technology standpoint, or you know, kind of in the clinic, in the care setting.
Let me take it from the clinical side,
sure,
first,
yeah.
Because I think that the big thing is the healthcare system, as we talked about, is really stressed out right now. Huge amounts of turnover, you know, not as experienced individuals, all those kind of things, and you know, anything we can do to make that patient experience better and safer and cause less stress on the healthcare system is going to be really important. I mean, if most of your patients are getting devices that have a significant risk of infection or clotting off, and if we can do something about that, that's going to cause less stress for the healthcare professionals in their job and a better experience for the patient themselves.
From my side, I'm just excited about getting our product into more and more hospitals and get it into the patients that are really suffering, right? And I think that's been the exciting part for us over the last 6 months is, you know, we've gone from an approved product. Now we have three. Now we have a sales force, and we've treated, you know, 2,500 patients, and the results of which have been, you know, really, really transformational when you compare it to what's out there. And so the ability to see something that we've created from essentially a wooden lab bench to something that is in patients and doing what we thought it could do, not just from a vaporware perspective, but we're showing it clinically in real-world evidence. I'm just excited about the promise of what we've been able to create and just continuing to proliferate that into other hospitals and other products.
I'm really fascinated by this 30%. It's incident rate on these procedures.
You should probably be horrified by it. Fascinated is another word.
Well, I have both. What moves the needle in terms of how far you bring down that number? And do you have any data on how the reduction in terms of incident rates that your technology?
Sure. I think when we first started the company, I thought any sort of impact to that 30% rate would be, you know, phenomenal. But now that we've treated 2,500 patients, we have three retrospective studies that have been completed, all powered to show a difference. So in our first study, we focused on midlines. We did about 100 controls in 100 of our devices. And the overall failure rate in the control was about 24%. For various reasons, and ours was just below 4%. So pretty significant, change in outcomes for all of those patients.
Yeah, that's so 4% rather than 24%.
That's right.
That's amazing. So I would assume when you started this process, you thought, okay, 30%, anywhere we get down, that increases our sales prospects, right? So now that you have this pretty incredible number here, are you seeing the uptick that you'd expected given the results?
I think, you know, a little bit of that is hard to evaluate based on when we started, right? So we started the sales process towards the very end of last year and really in earnest at the beginning of this year. And I think for any new product, to get through in acute care facilities, it really takes about 6 to 9 months in the best case, and so we are, you know, on our way. We've been hitting our revenue targets with a very small focused sales force, but I do think the thing that I am surprised about is as we go through that value analysis process, which every company has to go through. The incumbents that sort of have a decent amount of control over, shockingly, over the supply chain at each one of these facilities has gotten in our way. Now we're working our way around that, but I think it does slow down the rate of adoption and innovation. And so we're working through that.
I mean, your core product at Access Vascular is made here in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. I imagine you have components of kits that are maybe sourced internationally. I guess, so the first part is that different than your competition that you have a domestically produced core product? And I don't know, depending on that answer, does that matter at all in this analysis?
I think it didn't matter until about the last 2 years, right? I think domestically, the two things that we've seen dramatically, or maybe three things that we've seen dramatically change in terms of when we interact with different hospitals. A lot of the questions, I don't think I've ever heard this prior, is, you know, do you manufacture in the United States, right? Because of shipping issues, shipping concerns, right? There's about to be another whole, you know, wave of issues with supply chain as driven by OUS issues. And so that's a big question. Guaranteeing supply as part of the agreement. So that's, you know, sort of been there before, but the emphasis on, hey, if we switch to you, you need to guarantee with some pretty strong language, uninterrupted supply. And so, you know, between sourcing domestically, those supply chain issues, and then, you know, the questions around guarantees, I would say, yes, I think there are, everyone's having supply chain issues. And I think sourcing domestically and vertically is really important.
What are the implications of COVID for vascular care long-term, 10 years from now? Are there implications?
Yeah, I think the medical community really thinks that there's this underlying smoldering of chronic care that's going to really raise its head in the next 7 to 10 years, which is unfortunate, but that means potentially more hospitalizations or some type of facility to allow the patient to receive care. And most of them are going to need a vascular access device. Now, if it's an outpatient facility, you're still going to have the vascular access device. And if you think just about the failure rate, any time that one of those clogs off and you can't insert medication or withdraw from it, now you've got a whole another pathway of care that they're going to have to go down. Plus, it's a disappointment of the patient. It's the stress on the healthcare professional to say, oh, I went to just give her the medication or him the medication. Now I can't use this line. I got to get another one. So when does that occur? Where do they go during that time to wait, especially if we go to more outpatient centers like we saw early and midway during COVID where we were doing outpatient infusions? Well, if we don't keep those things functioning, you create a whole nother series of potential problems. And I really think that, gosh, in the next 7 to 10 years, we're going to have, you know, some real issues to be dealt with in the U.S. and around the world.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break and watch a tour we took of your facility at Access Vascular. And on the other side of that, we'll continue the discussion.
Boyd Technologies is an advanced materials and technology company operating in the medical device and life sciences market. We're experts in regulated single-use devices and liquid media solutions. Our growth platform provides a full suite of services for design and development, advanced manufacturing, and fulfillment operations. To learn more, visit us at boydtech.com.
Welcome to Access Vascular in Billerica, Massachusetts. Jim, it's great to be here. Thank you so much for hosting us.
Matt, we're really excited to have you here and look forward to showing you our brand new facility.
We're going to take a facility tour, see your engineering and manufacturing capabilities, meet some of your team. Before we go in, just tell me a little bit about this new facility and what you guys are building here in the vascular access market.
Really, the mission of the company, first and foremost, is to address the most common and costly complications that plague a $4.5 billion market. And we do that with our proprietary biomaterial. I'm sure we'll talk more about that as we take the tour. But really, the facility is set up so we have operations, right, the manufacturing portion of what we do, alongside the R&D component, which is really integral to our ability to get products to the market quickly and innovate on our material technology in real time.
I'm really excited to see it. Can we take a look?
Absolutely. Let's go.
So can you walk me through some of your core technology here?
Why don't we start with the competitive product? If you sort of feel that this is a polyurethane device, it's very common in the space. Actually, all the devices that are currently commercialized, with the exception of ours, are the same material. Right. And so we've been able to create this novel platform technology and introduce it right now, three different products. So we actually have three products that are commercially available in the U.S., and all of them benefit from the from our novel technology. And so when you feel sort of the characteristics of that material, you can really appreciate the difference when you move to ours, right? So our technology is essentially this white tubing. Once it's hydrated, this product is about 40% water, and so it goes from a relatively more rigid state to something that's a little more flexible, so it's more conducive to inserting into the body. And the other sort of added benefit is really the lubricious nature of the material itself. So if you feel that in the dry state, and then we hydrate very quickly, you can feel the difference in terms of two things, right? You can feel the lubricity, and you can also feel the flexibility start to get more in line with this product here.
Your background is plastics engineering. You went to UMass Lowell. You're really the CTO, the founder, but the science behind this product, right?
Yeah, certainly I had a hand in it, but also had a tremendous amount of help. Right, so back in the early days, we started with a wooden lab bench and a hot plate, and through sort of, working within the network, finding people that were passionate about solving these problems for patients, we're able to sort of get enough momentum, get enough brain power, if you will, to develop the product, develop the material, and ultimately build the company that you're here to see today. So it really started with that wooden lab bench, and now we're in 40,000 square feet. We have three products that are commercial, building products in the region. So we're really happy about where the product has come from and where we're taking the company in general.
Another part of your story that I love is, how you gained access to clinicians and to really discovering the need for this product application. Can you talk a little bit about the Ignite program and how that helped?
I mean, as you know, in Massachusetts and really greater New England, there's a ton of resources, right? Really great resources that enable people to develop new technologies and bring these products to market. And as you indicated, MassMedic was a huge part of that with their program, the Ignite program. That allowed me to get in front of clinicians for 18 to 24 months and really immerse myself in the problems that are occurring in hospitals, which is really where we identified this problem to try to address.
It's such a great story. I think we're going to go talk to your R&D team now and learn a little bit more about the process of R&D and how you guys integrate that with manufacturing.
Yeah, you'll have a great time with Kristen. She's extremely knowledgeable.
Kristen, it's great to meet you. So you're the head of R&D at AVI. Can you talk to me a little bit about your key technology that you guys are bringing into the market?
Our technology is a catheter technology for vascular access. And what's unique about our product is that it is designed to evade the body's natural response to attack foreign objects that come in. So we are really aimed at reducing long-term complications that exist.
Talk to me a little bit about the R&D department here, kind of how you guys fit into the company and how important you are to its future.
I look at it as we kind of hold the product portfolio in our hands. We work cross-functionally to identify where the focus area should be, what the priority should be, but we are really leading the effort on product development and evolution and also developing our intellectual property.
Thanks for taking the time to speak with us today. I think we're going to go talk to Amy in marketing now.
So I'm the upstream product manager for Access Vascular. So I am the one responsible for looking at the needs of customers, bringing that to our development team to make sure that we're developing products that meet those needs.
Yeah, let's talk about the improvement you guys are making to patients' lives. How does this product impact the patient?
Well, most people who are hospitalized end up with a peripheral or central line catheter at some point in their stay. And one of the biggest challenges with that is that those catheters can lead to thrombosis. Our technology is uniquely designed to prevent thrombosis to as much of an extent as we can, so it can help to make that patient's stay and that patient's journey one less thing for them to worry about while they're being treated for their disease.
One of the other things I'm really fascinated about with Access Vascular is the connectivity between marketing and R&D and engineering and manufacturing. They really seem to have a tight feedback loop there to bring these innovations into the market. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's one of the things that I like the most about working here. We have a small team. We're constantly working together, running ideas off of each other, As they're developing products and prototypes, if they have questions about, you know, what features are needed, they come directly to me and I can go out to customers and get that input so that we have a quick turnaround time between where the question is and what the resolution is to that.
That's great. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. We're going to go talk to your engineering team now.
Excellent. Thank you. Have a great day.
My role at Access Vascular as an NPI engineer is to bridge the gap between our R&D colleagues and our manufacturing colleagues for product development and process development of our extruded products.
Tell me a little bit about that process, how you move from R&D and engineering and do your tech transfer into production.
As we work with our R&D colleagues on new product development, we work with the design, the tooling, and the process. And then as we develop both the product and the process, it gives us a foothold, a measure, and an established process to transfer to our manufacturing colleagues.
So you must bring some experience to your job here. How long have you been at Access, and what did you do before this?
Well, I've been at Access Vascular for about a year, and I've been involved in the health sciences in what I would call plastics engineering type roles, whether it's materials or process development, for pretty much most of my career.
Can you talk a little bit about the benefits of having this tight feedback loop between having literally R&D next door to manufacturing and how you are able to move innovation through not just your facility but out into the market quickly?
Without both groups being under the same roof, there's oftentimes a disconnect between the R&D needs and the reality of manufacturing. So having us in the same facility enables us to communicate closely together so that we can develop the product and the process simultaneously in real time and succeed on both fronts.
You guys are going through an interesting transition right now. This is a new facility in January, I think, and you're kind of scaling up production. Tell me just a little bit about what that's like in operations.
It keeps us busy, right? We came from an 8,000 square foot facility just down the road, and now we're at 40,000 square feet. So it's an opportunity to scale operations and allow us to introduce a lot more capital equipment into the facility, which allows us to scale.
And I hear you have some new products coming from R&D and engineering into production, so can you describe that?
The next one is really our Dulumen catheter. Right now we're just finishing up our validation activity from a R&D standpoint. We're actually rolling that out over the next few months into manufacturing, so we're pretty excited to get that out to manufacturing and to have the opportunity to scale that as well.
Can you tell me about your role here at Access Vascular?
Yeah, I'm a senior medical operator, and I also help with our extrusion process.
Tell me a little bit about that. What is extrusion, and you know, how do you utilize that here in your manufacturing facility?
Basically, we take our in-house polymer that we mix here, and we put it through a feeder, and it goes through the extruder and actually creates our catheters through with the puller and cutter also.
What kind of quality controls do you have around this production process?
Before and after and during our extruding process, we take samples of catheters and measure the, under a microscope, measure the OD, the ovality, and the length and thickness of the catheters themselves.
And how long have you been working here?
We'll be a year in August.
Okay, cool. And what's your favorite thing about working at Access Vascular?
The family atmosphere, the people make it easy to come to work there. I couldn't ask for a better place to be.
Hi, Chanti, it's great to meet you. Can you tell me about your role here?
My role here is I am a manufacturing operator.
And this manufacturing facility, you do all of your production from start to finish for all your products here, or do you have any other manufacturing elsewhere?
All the product is built here, and I'm very proud to start from extrusion to finished packing.
That's one of my favorite parts about the Access Vascular story, building a growing workforce here in Massachusetts. You're doing all your manufacturing right here from start to finish.
For more than a quarter of a century, MassMedic has been the voice of the groundbreaking medical technology industry in New England, advocating for sound public policy that supports innovation and fostering a community built on a shared purpose, saving and improving the lives of patients everywhere through medical technology. Since the beginnings of New England's dominance in health tech, our members, the women and men who make up MassMedic, are researching, designing, developing, supplying, manufacturing, and deploying the next generation of medical innovations around the globe. Heart of Health Tech beats here in Massachusetts. And at MassMedic, We're proud to be part of that journey. Learn more about how you can join our community at massmedic.com.
Okay, welcome back. Jim, I'd like to start this segment digging into a little bit of a discussion about your manufacturing capabilities and engineering, which we took a look at when we toured your facility. Can you talk a little bit about the benefit of the proximity of these capabilities in your facility, where you have your team doing product development and transfer to manufacturing right there in the same facility?
Yeah, I mean, you're hitting on one of the biggest, you know, strategic, you know, questions we had early on, right? Do we outsource everything, and we just have R&D, and we have, you know, regulatory and some of the other functions, and sort of pay someone else to do the manufacturing? And I think at the end of the day, you know, my school of thought, maybe it's a little old school, but I think we gain a tremendous amount of value from the learnings of manufacturing our own materials and devices in-house. And I think the problem is that that's really hard to quantify, especially when you're starting out, and that's big expenses, right? It's much easier to outsource it, and you know that's variable cost. But when you insource it all, it's extremely expensive. And I think we're seeing the benefits of it now. But it's not an obvious choice when you're starting a company. So in terms of the benefits, I think because we have a novel material, the ability to process it and learn every time you're processing it and then take that into the next product is tremendously, you know, beneficial for our development and R&D cycle. What we do choose to do is we outsource a lot of the other things that we don't do well, or we don't bring enough value to. Assembly of kits, sourcing of other components, sterilization, drop shipping. So we really focus on what's our core competencies in terms of the secret sauce, and leverage that internally. And then whoever, you know, we choose to partner with, making sure that they're best in class in terms of what they bring to the table as well. So lots of different synergies there in terms of having the manufacturing and R&D in one spot.
Is that part of your original business plan to build manufacturing, or were you like thinking, because I mean, different reality then, but I mean.
Yeah, I think when I started, I knew that there was going to be a lot of value in having specific processes in-house and learning from that. So I think that part has always been part of the value proposition that we bring when we talk to investors. We have, if anything, we've brought more in-house than we were anticipating. And I think that's a function of seeing how other companies are impacted by not being completely vertically integrated and the disruption that has on the business.
Can you take us inside the investor conversations? I mean, this sounds really like it's come from your business acumen and kind of understanding of what was going to be successful, but how did you convince investors of that?
It's an interesting question. I don't think there was a lot of convincing, right? Maybe if it was less reliant on process, maybe if our product and technology was less reliant on having that expertise, maybe that question would be there, right? If we're creating a purely mechanical device that doesn't have any new materials, you know, maybe they would have pushed back or questioned it. But I didn't really get that much pushback or questioning. And we scaled with time, right? We didn't start off with a 40,000 square foot facility. We really started with something much smaller and then just sort of stepped through that process and upgraded as we got more and more investment.
Is there a feedback loop benefit from clinic to engineering to transfer to new, you know, in terms of generating new technology and new products? I mean, do you see that just as simply an efficiency that you have?
I would say I think we struggled with that a little bit over the last couple of years because it was nearly impossible to get our, you know, engineers or even marketing and salespeople in to do cases and observe. And so maybe we suffered a little bit from the lack of having that access, but certainly that access to, you know, watch procedure is invaluable when it comes to innovation and just constructing whatever product is going to come out. You're watching somebody do something is completely different than envisioning how they would do it, right? It's always it's always imperative that you are, to the greatest extent possible, not disrupting clinical workflow, which is much easier said than done, because any sort of change in clinical workflow, clinicians have been trained and have been doing these things for so long that it's much more disruptive than you would hope, even if you just change something 10%. So being able to completely follow that clinical workflow without disruption is something we frankly struggled with early on. Our device needs to be hydrated. There is a hydration step in every other procedure, but initially we had to wait a little bit longer. We've since fixed that, rightfully so. We had like a 10-minute hydration, which we sort of envisioned as, okay, you'll set up the kit first, then you'll prep the patient, and then by the time you prep the patient, catheter will be ready to go. And so we did a lot of market research and said, all right, that sounds like it doesn't disrupt clinical workflow. But when we got into it, as soon as we saw a few procedures and watched, we're like, okay, we got to figure out how to get that hydration time to, near zero if possible. And sort of just having the experience of watching the procedure, even though you did all this work up front, was invaluable.
Yeah, that's like the hardest part about med tech innovation is, everybody focused on in innovation in a bubble, you're focused on disruption. You're focused on changing patterns of behavior, right? But in medical technology innovation, you have to fit disruption, maybe downplay disruption, fit disruption within a current, existing framework of not changing the fundamental nature of what a clinician or a surgeon is doing. That's just like the advanced level stuff. That's the hardest part, I think, in my opinion.
I think it was either you or Michael who really got me to think about to what extent can you change the workflow? And I forget what your numbers were, but it's directly related to the overall impact you have on the outcome.
Right. It can't be a big impact and little outcome because change is hard in medical therapy. But it's also how we help them change what they were doing, and that is rarely are you just selling a device. Really, you actually have to sell the training, the workflow, all those kind of things. And where I think Access Vascular has really changed the paradigm is that they also discuss that, there's different generations of healthcare workers out there. How do we train all the different generations differently so that we're not trying to jam a square plug in a round hole? And there aren't that many companies that'll internalize that, but no matter what business you run, you better internalize it, right? Because us of the baby boom is almost gone, and now they've got a whole different generation or two or three that are in your workforce that you have to treat differently.
And we talked a little bit offline about, how working with Gary and the others at Healthcare Insights has helped us really refine our thought process of moving forward. And I think this dovetails perfectly into one of the biggest takeaways that we had been thinking about, but really hadn't formalized what we were doing, is really looking at the procedure from as many angles as possible. And so now that we have a formalized program, which really focuses on three major things. One is procedural standardization, so making sure that as we go in, we can help to educate and guide and ensure that INS standards are being followed and that every procedure, to the extent that we can help, is following this standardization, which will bring you a certain way through better outcomes. And then it's continued education. Right, as things progress and as we learn, as things continue to move forward in the field, we can hopefully help with that because we have some clinical expertise there and gaining knowledge all the time. And then thirdly, it's this whole fee-for-service to value-based care. And we actually provide a guarantee on the performance of our products that if there are issues, we sort of back up the performance because we now have that confidence. So it's really tying all three of those things together to get you to the outcomes that people are looking for.
An interesting segue. I think you both mentioned workforce a little bit there. Jim, for you guys scaling now a business, obviously it's talked a lot about right now, labor force challenges. What are those challenges like for you, but what are the key skill sets that you're in need of to scale your business?
I've changed my thought process about this quite a bit over the last 7 years. I think historically in the beginning, I was always looking for, okay, who's got the best resume? Who's got the best experience? Who's worked at the companies I want to see? Who's done the things that we are trying to do? And I would hire for those things. And I think over time, I realized that, and this might be cliche at this point, but really hire for fit and attitude, and then, you know, work with whoever that candidate is to make sure that they're supported and we have the skill set overall to be successful, because you can't change mindset and effort. You know, you can't change experiences and provide different support. But ultimately, you know, we are primarily focused on finding the people that have, you know, similar values to us, to the point where, you know, we've created a set of values that we not only hire for and ask about during interviews, but also try to instill in everyone as we move the company forward. And so it's been a tough hiring environment. I think a lot of companies have capitulated towards, you know, what the hiring environment looks like. And we, you know, we do that to an extent, but really we just want people that who believe in what we're doing and want to be involved in sort of changing the standard of care. And so that's really what we've focused on. You know, we're trying to scale up. We need to hire quite a few people on the operations side. And so we're busy doing that and hiring some additional salespeople. So lots of different needs for us. You know, we're trying to make sure that those spots and positions are filled, but not to the detriment of hiring the wrong person.
As a manufacturer, you know, there's unique challenges because you can't work from home if you're in operations. How have you guys managed that just as we've evolved through this new period of time?
Yeah, I think that's one thing that we're evolving all the time, just internally. What are we asking of employees? What are our expectations? And I think where we can provide flexibility, you know, we're only hiring people that we trust to be able to, you know, work remotely. And so the work remote thing is really about making sure that we're getting things done. And so, you know, we don't, in a lot of our business, you can work remotely. We have a bunch of people in marketing that work remotely, and that works great for us. In terms of the you know, manufacturing operation side, like you said, that there's really no option. And so you can try to extend some of those same, you know, benefits to that group. But at the end of the day, you know, people have to be there a set amount of hours and have to be able to build products. So there's unfortunately not as much flexibility there.
Gary, what about the hospital? I mean, how concerned are you, I guess, or I assume concerned about just the healthcare workforce as we go forward from here?
Yin yang here. I mean, there's been we talked about a mass exodus out of the healthcare industry. However, there's also a mass entrance. So, you know, nursing students enrollment's up, medical students enrollment up. It's just that there's a big lag during that time. I think that the big challenge is going to be, how do you balance the burnout that's been occurring? I hate that term, actually, but it's realistically, it's the overworking of your current workforce and the big influx of contract workers that demanded huge amounts of salary. Boy, getting back to that balance of my regular employees that I'm having work a lot of overtime versus my contractors that are making top dollar and can, you know, realistically go home at the end of the day. Getting back into more of an equilibrium is going to be, I think, a rocky pathway, but you got to get there. So I think it's just going to be working hand in hand. And a lot of people that are in healthcare, I really think, are there because they want to help people. I mean, that's probably the number one reason when you talk to them. Why'd you get into this? I wanted to help people. And if we can play on that and really help them instill that value back in themselves and really value what they're doing, I think we'll get a long way.
That's really encouraging, actually, from to hear you say, just to have enrollments up and, you know, it sounds like enthusiasm for the field of healthcare is there very much. It's just we have this gap now.
Jim, in your own evolution as a leader, how have you grown as a CEO? You know, I'm sure when you started this, you thought of yourself as a founder, and, you know, probably had
certain expectations about how long it would take or how hard it would be.
Sure.
But I'm curious. I've watched you, through this journey evolve and become really, really adept at not only leading your company, but talking about your company, talk about how your technology fits within. As you look back on your journey, where do you feel like you've made the biggest strides?
First of all, I appreciate all the kind words. And I think just the overall increase in responsibility as we raise more money, as we have products, on the market, the responsibility that comes with, taking care of 40 or working with 40 individuals from various backgrounds and, those types of things. I think it's just the leadership aspect. I've really enjoyed progressively taking on more and more responsibility and having that ability to lead, a group of people, towards evolutionizing, what's available for, vascular access. I think those are the areas that I'm sort of most proud of and feel like I've grown the most is on that leadership side, being able to, deal with, board members, investors, clinicians, and as you mentioned, been able to overcome and address more issues related to the business than I ever had imagined would come up. But I think at the end of the day, when we get through the tunnel here and ultimately are successful with the products and with the technology, I feel like that's where I'm gaining the most growth and opportunity.
Yeah, because when I first interviewed you, we talked about the technology. It was all about the technology, and the novelness, the novelty of the technology or the way, the disruptiveness of the technology. But now when I hear you talk about this, I hear so much more of the why, the technology, and you must have probably through 1,000 times of getting, hitting the wall that you just kept growing. Is how hard has it been as a journey for you to grow as the spokesperson for this?
Sure, it's tough. A lot of the stuff never came naturally to me as being sort of outspoken or verbose about what I'm doing, right? Tend to downplay all that stuff. I think the support and sort of the stroke of luck I've had with great advisors like Gary, a great board of directors. Dr. Michael Joff has been hugely influential in terms of my sort of understanding of, fee for service versus value based care, the impact that we could have on patients, the economic side of things. So it's really through advisors that I've been able to adapt, right? And without them, I don't know where I'd be, probably working somewhere else. But it's just through their experiences and working with them. I have a great, legal counsel that's helped me through the way, navigate through, deal structures and investors and things. Because of his experience. So it's really on the shoulder of all those people that have had been able to get the company to where it is.
Through tough times. I mean, if you think about like anybody who's had to lead an organization, like March of 2020, like you weren't just leading a company. You're like trying to like assure your people that worked with you that they were going to have a job or they were going to not go broke or you had their back like when the worst was on it. So I mean, it's just, I mean, like, it's worth it to just recognize that, like, that you've had to do that and you've had to do that. Like, I've had to do it to some extent, too. It's like,
I joined our business in 2000 and the very end of 2007 and right before the financial crisis. And which was very difficult for our business. One of my father's friends said to me in the middle of 2008, or I think it was 2009 probably, but he said, "You'll be better for this. This will be the best thing that ever happened in your career." And I sort of looked at him and said, "Really? Are you sure about that?" But in hindsight, it gives you perspective that's really valuable.
Sure, and I think it's through the hard times where you learn how to get through things. And unless you face that personally and had to get through it, then you haven't been able to adapt and get better. We were talking about this earlier about our parenting approaches, making sure that, how do you sort of, make your kids stronger, and how do they adjust to things and helping them out to a certain extent. But it's in some ways it's sort of very analogous, right? It's like unless you go through these things, unless you go through the pain, you
gift of failure.
Yeah. That's for sure. So
my dad always said, you don't learn to drive on the straightaways, on the curves.
That's important to have perspective too. I think think about the fact you're in the market, that you're selling, that you're performing and meeting your numbers, and after what we've gone through, it's great work. It's incredible, and I'm really excited to see what you guys have done and to see that you have 40 employees now.
Sure.
Because like I said, I watched the whole journey. It's really exciting.
I think the length of it too. I mean, I think for me, I love that about the life sciences industry at large this is not a place for quick wins.
Sure.
And I think you learn that. That's probably the only thing you do quickly is you learn that it's not a place for quick wins. And
quick one would be nice once in a while.
Yeah, right.
It's not discount a quick win.
You keep that hope alive.
I think we are out of time, so we're going to leave it there. But I want to thank you, Gary, for joining us and lending your perspective and expertise. It's been fantastic. And Jim, thanks for trusting us with your story and sharing it. It's really inspiring, and I'm excited to watch your progress from here. Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate being part of this. So thanks.
Thanks.